I've just developed a terrible cough. I don't know what it is. Maybe my excitement for being here or something like that. But, you know, you mentioned Brother Skousen and how you'd been studying with him. And just as a little side note, perhaps, when he died, I was out of town. And my wife called me that morning and told me that he had passed away. But it was very interesting that that night I had dreamed, and one of the things I really like to do in the evenings and nights is to be out on the dark nights and be able to see the shooting stars. That's considered a good evening for me, you know. It shows you how exciting my life is, I guess. But I really enjoy a shooting star. Excuse me. Thank you. There's two. Did something else want to share with me? Anyway, the night he passed away, I had, as I say, been out of town and was in a hotel and had a dream. And in that dream, there was shooting stars. There were, obviously I couldn't count how they were, but there was probably 40 or 50 a second. It was like they were just streaming across the sky in the in that dream, and I thought, whoa, this is incredible. I wonder what this is all about. Well, then in the morning, Tammy calls me and tells me that Brother Skousen has called, and I had passed away. And I made a connection there. It was as though there was a sign in the heavens or something. But I don't usually dream about shooting stars. I just go look for them. So, kind of a interesting little side note, I guess. We've talked the last couple of times we were here about different subjects, and I've referred a couple of times to a book by the name of A View of the Constitution of the United States. It's View of the Constitution of the United States. It doesn't have an in front of it. And it was written by a man by the name of St. George Tucker. And this is the book right here. It's a book that almost nobody in modern America has ever heard of, seen, or read. And it's an incredible book. Those of you that love the Constitution, the tradition of the Founding Fathers, I strongly recommend it. It's written in the language and the era, and I'm going to use a lot of quotes tonight from it. In fact, this is kind of a book report of this book tonight, so it'll kind of get your interest. Oh, when did it publish? Oh, that's another good important question. 1803. And we'll tell you a little bit more about St. George Tucker as we get started here. But this is a book that should be on everybody's shelf that cares about this nation. It's a perspective that is not told at all in this nation anymore. And those of you that believe the Founding Fathers said what they meant what they said, all the way through they shall be cheering. The message almost gets old. I mean, it's so redundant. And in my opinion, the central theme of this book is what I'm going to talk on tonight. Now, there's other things interwoven in it too, but the name that I've titled this little presentation is called A Limited Government Whose Powers Are Few and Well-Defined. And that kind of captures, I think, the essence of this book. St. George Tucker was very, very explicit in that. And he repeated it again and again and again. Not maybe in that exact way, but almost every page has that message on it. Okay, I thought I had a hand back there. So anyway, the book right now is available from the Liberty Fund. I don't know if any of you have got anything from them out of Annapolis. They don't have a phone number in here, but I know that I've called their 800 number before and ordered books, and it's just something you've just got to get on your calling list. I was going to give you the ISBN, but we can do that after, I guess, if you want. But I really recommend it. I'd say get it. So that's what we're going to talk about today, a limited government whose powers are few and well-defined. And this is basically a book review. Well, let me tell you a little bit about St. George Tucker. St. George Tucker was born in 1752 in Bermuda. And in 1771, he migrated to the Virginia colony and he began to study law. Well, he studied at the College of William and Mary under George Wythe. George Wythe was kind of his mentor, if you will, in terms of the subject of law. He succeeded George Wythe as the professor for the College of William and Mary as a professorship of law there in 1790. So he's the guy that kind of filled the shoes of George Wythe when he got out of the business. He was admitted to the bar in 1775, and he ended up shortly thereafter getting involved in the fight for liberty with the colonies. He joined the militia and became a colonel. He fought under Nathanael Greene in North Carolina. And then, and he was, you know, the reports are that he deported himself very bravely in the campaigns there. And at the Battle of Yorktown, he was serving under General Thomas Nelson, and he was wounded in that battle. So after the war, he continued his successful law practice. He was appointed to a commission that was to revise Virginia's laws. Thomas Jefferson was involved in that effort also. And he was prominent enough that he was asked to be the Virginia commissioner that went to the Annapolis Convention, which was an early attempt to modify the existing Constitution at that time, which were the Articles of Confederation. So he was very much involved in trying to formulate this whole government that we were putting together in those days. Well, when he taught law school, he taught out of Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England. And of course, they were written, the title says, of England. And the colonies had become states and had fought a war to obtain their independence. And so he kind of thought, well, let's see if we can Americanize these things. We've moved away from the British jurisprudence. We've moved away from their form of government. And we need to kind of say, okay, here's how these differ from the way the national government is set up here in the United States now. So he tried to Americanize them. Well, he wrote a lot of essays, and the most prominent one is this view of the Constitution of the United States. All of them are very germane to trying to preserve the cause of liberty because they capture the tradition of the Founding Fathers. They capture what the Founding Fathers meant when they said what they did. Now, a lot of you are familiar with the term the Living Constitution, and we could probably, during this, I'll blend a little bit of that in, but really and truly, you can clearly understand what they meant if you read their words and study what they wrote about, okay? Well, anyway, so Tucker started focusing on the commentaries, and he started trying to Americanize them, and this view of the Constitution evolved from that. And so it's not really a full commentary on the commentaries of the laws of England, but it had that as its frame of reference in many cases. But then he also began to use the Articles of Confederation and do a compare and contrast between what they were and what the United States Constitution was. And when they were similar, he pointed that out. And it's important to realize that there were similarities. And they were similar because they had experience with what worked, and they basically incorporated that into the new document. And what didn't, they cast aside. So we'll talk a little bit about that, I think, tonight, too. He was a fellow Virginian with George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison. And they were very close together on all of their perspectives. In fact, you know, it's kind of like when H. Verlin Anderson, whose book was mentioned a minute ago, passed away. Were any of you at his funeral, by the way? Nobody attended his funeral. At any rate, Ezra Taft Benson was very, very close to H. Verlin Anderson. And Ezra Taft Benson was aged and ill when H. Verlin Anderson passed on. So both Gordon B. Hinckley and Thomas S. Monson attended the funeral and spoke, obviously, you know, when they're there. And you always ask them to talk. That's protocol, by the way, if you're ever in that situation. So anyway, they both spoke, and they both commented about how close Ezra Taft Benson was to H. Verlin Anderson and how he wished that he could have been there. Well, anyway, after the funeral, there was a bunch of people that were kind of close to the family and knew each other and were, you know, kind of all of this patriotic gene, if you will, that gathers us together. And somebody made a comment, and by the way, Reed Benson was standing in the circle, and somebody made the comment, well, isn't that nice that President Hinckley and President Monson made comment about how close your dad, speaking to Reed, and H. Verlin were. And Reed put his fingers like this, and he said they were just like that. And My first introduction, by the way, to H. Merlin Andersen, I know I'm diverging again, and I apologize for that. I do this a lot. But my first introduction to H. Merlin Andersen was when I'd read. In fact, I read The Great and Abominable Church of the Devil before I read the Many Are Called and Few Are Chosen. I would prefer that most people read them in reverse. I think The Many Are Called is kind of the milk, if you will, and then The Great and Abominable is the meat, if you will. But I read them in reverse, and it was like one of those things, like this book here that I'm talking about tonight, I was cheering all the way through. I was like, whoa, this is so good. So I called him on the phone out of the blue, and of course he was a general authority, and he took my call. And I says, you know, I've just finished your book, and I loved it. Do you still believe it? And he said, well, yes. And I said, well, oh man, that's so good to hear, because I didn't read anything in there that contradicted the prophets. And he says, Brother Bradley, he says, will you do me a favor? I said, what's that? He says, will you read it again, please? And read it carefully, because if you find anything in there that contradicts the brethren, I want to know so I can correct it. I mean, he was just that kind of guy. And from there, we had a kind of an interesting a friendship that was, that was, to me, interesting, because we'd get into these discussions, and he was so pure-minded and so, he just didn't want to think ill of anybody. And perhaps sometimes I do. Maybe I do after I go look at what's happening in the world. And so we'd get in these discussions. I say, but Brother Andersen, what if this were happening? What would you do? And he'd say, well, it couldn't happen. I said, but what if it was? Because I knew it was. And he said, well, it just couldn't. You know, and we're in a free land under the Constitution. I said, but what if somebody were violating the Constitution and doing this? And we'd have these kind of discussions. And sometimes we just had to agree to disagree, because he didn't think that anybody would be as nefarious as they are sometimes. And so, anyway, I guess I've diverged there, but because I was doing this, they were just like this. Yes, sir. I don't know. Hans told me that too. I think that there's probably. I'm only supposing, so this is only me. Please don't take this anywhere, because, I mean, well, how do you say something in an audience like this and not have it go anywhere? But I suspect that we're in trying times, and sometimes, well, there's a guy, for example, up in our neighborhood. Maybe you've heard about him. He just got arrested Sunday. Did you hear about this guy that was a tax protester that got arrested? Oh, he's going to burn down the country. I mean, these aren't his exact words, but he did, in writing, tell some IRS agents he was going to execute him. And, you know, the big hammer came down on his head, and they came in with federal agents and backup from all of the local agencies and all that kind of stuff, and they swooped in and picked him up. And, you know, it's one of those things where some people, I guess, we get so passionate about things that we maybe go about finding solutions in the wrong way. And I guess what we ought to be doing is we still have a constitution. We still have ways to peacefully change the problems that we have in this country. And there are those that try to, as a one-man army, go out and fight it. And, you know, when they do it and they suggest violence, there's people that are willing to just come in and swoop them up and put them in jail, and that's all you hear from them. And they've just got to... they've taken themselves out of the battle. So I guess I would suggest, perhaps, that as we go about trying to preserve these concepts, that we work in a way that is principled, that is logical, that has a civil demeanor to it, and while not giving them, at this point, any excuse for swooping in and taking us out of the fight, remembering always that we can change, because we do have the vote. We do still retain a way of changing it. People oftentimes ask me, and again, I'm getting diverged here, isn't it time for another revolution? Should we take up arms and all that kind of stuff? And I say there's still hope. We can still change it. We can still make this thing right again if we'll just be wise enough to approach it by the means the Founding Fathers gave us, this petitioning of government and attempting to change it through education and all these kind of things. I don't think the revolutionary time is yet. At any rate, Ezra Taft Benson, H. Merlin Andersen were just like this, according to Reed Benson. Well, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and Tucker, in many ways, were just like this. And as we go through this little review, I'm going to be quoting some of those other men, not just Tucker. And I think you'll see that they were very, very much on the same wavelength about the proper role of government and what had been established by the Founding Fathers. So anyway, this is kind of an analysis of some of his selected writings, particularly this view of the Constitution. Unequivocally, and in a brilliant way, he stipulates that the government established by the United States Constitution is absolutely limited in scope and power. And if you don't believe that by the time we get done, I probably missed it somehow, because I'm probably, before I get done, you'll get tired of hearing me say almost the same words, and you'll go, we've heard it. Okay, we believe you. Because he was just so that unequivocal about it. Well, anyway, at the time, though, if any of you've studied the writings of Thomas Jefferson and some of the things that were going on at that era, and the big conflict of political power that was going on between the faction that was led by John Adams and perceived to be Alexander Hamilton, and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison on the other hand, you know. Some of you are probably familiar with that. But there was this movement, it seemed, in the nation that by some that were attempting to restore monarchy to the nation. And they called them monarchists, and I think Hamilton was kind of a monarchist. I don't think that Adams really was. I think that he was more of an aristocratic guy in many ways, but I don't think he ever sought to restore a monarchy. But that was they were really kind of loggerheads. And you know, Adams and Jefferson were the closest of friendships in the early years. I mean, they were brothers, if you will, in this cause of liberty. They sat together in the Independence Hall to write the Declaration of Independence. And in fact, the initial request had been that John Adams write the Declaration of Independence. And he turned to Thomas Jefferson and said, no, you should write it. And he said, why? He said, well, first of all, nobody likes me. And second of all, you write a lot better than I do. So anyway, Thomas Jefferson, thankfully, was given that assignment to be the principal author, if you will, of the Declaration of Independence. But at any rate, in 1803, there had been this upheaval and the election that had occurred with Jefferson just before that. And there had been this huge, it was a political battle. It wasn't violent, but it was a political battle in which there was this perception that it was the monarchists that were pitted against the Republicans. And I've never seen Jefferson ever use the term Democratic Republican, by the way, if for some people that say he started that party. But at any rate, so in a way, it was kind of between the king man and the free man, if you will. And so the battle was really familiar to everybody at the time. And that's the setting that this 1803 book was published in. He wanted to make absolutely certain that people knew that monarchy was wrong. Again, now, Adams, I don't think, ever embraced that. And, of course, friends at first became friends at last, as Adams and Jefferson reconciled after Jefferson's presidency, and they became the closest of friends. And some of their letters are just brilliant exposures to two incredibly brilliant minds that were in this cause of liberty. And, of course, they both died the same day. You know the story about the 1826 July 4th time. So I don't need to review that. Well, Tucker, time and time again, talks about the scope and bounds of the United States government are limited to specifics, and that the people and the states only delegated certain powers to the United States. And Tucker viewed the Constitution as a restraint on the natural tendency of man to begin to usurp power once we get a little power. He said the Constitution was written to keep that from happening, which is, like I say, normally, whatever has power metastasizes into a leviathan that ultimately becomes tyranny. So he just wanted to make sure that people unequivocally understood that. And quite frankly, it was the perspective that was the predominant view in the nation at that time, that the government was limited and it had only been delegated certain powers. And Jefferson was masterful, by the way, as he came into the presidency, to basically reconcile some of these people that had thought that they were the Federalists, if you will, that were on the side of Adams. Some of them were just really tense and angry, and he had a very gentle outreach to them gathered them back in. He says, we're all Republicans, really. And gathered in these men that wanted freedom. And almost all of them, except for the real hardcore, became reconciled and became a very unified country again. But one of the things that Tucker talks about in his book is the great hue and cry that was there after the Constitution was written and presented to the people. Oh my goodness, what was the panic? The panic was there's no Bill of Rights. And of course, the argument on the side of the Founding Fathers that had been in the Constitutional Convention was, what do you need a Bill of Rights for? We didn't give the national government enough power to take away your rights. And on top of that, if you start listing your rights from a legalistic perspective, if you didn't put one there, you meant not to put it there, and consequently, you don't have that right. You purposely left it off. And of course, on the other hand, the people are saying, we don't care. We want to make sure there's further constraints on the government that specifically delineates the fact that we did not give power to undermine our God-given rights. So it went back and forth and back and forth. And the arguments in the ratification processes when they got out in the states, it became very, very apparent they were not going to be able to ratify the United States Constitution if there was not a Bill of Rights. And so the men that were key in bringing this forth said, okay, ratify it in the process, through the process we've got going. In fact, there had been calls to even call another constitutional convention. And they were extremely worried that that was going to happen. In fact, I've got some of Jefferson's writings, which is not the subject of this tonight, in which he pled with the people to not have another convention. Because the convention was so dangerous, they could lose what they had and go off on another tangent, and they would never be able to regather what they'd had. That danger is orders of magnitude more today. If we have a convention today, there is already a constitution written, basically. It would not be the one that would protect our God-given rights. It would be basically a socialistic perspective that allowed all sorts of perverse things that a lot of people would like to see brought into canon, if you will. So there was a great plea to not call another convention. And they said, okay, we give you our word that if you will ratify this constitution as written, our first order of business will be to create a Bill of Rights. We want you to submit rights, this Bill of Rights to us, and we will bring together, we'll pass them, we'll send them back out in the states for ratification. And I'm going by memory right now, so it might not be 100% accurate, but it's pretty close, I think. There were, I think, 189 amendments proposed. And some guys like George Mason and James Madison got together, and they said, well, here's one that says, you know, we get to keep and bear arms, and here's one that says that we should have guns. You know, well, let's put them together. So they boiled them down to, I think it was 15. They passed 12 and passed them on to the states. So they passed 12 amendments through the Article 5 process of the United States Constitution. So Congress passed those. Well, so they bring this forth, and the Congress put together a resolution in front of the amendments that they had passed as they sent them out to the states. And here's what it says. The Congress of the United States, begun and held at the city of New York on Wednesday, the 4th of March, 1789, the conventions of a number of the states having, now you can listen to this carefully because this will tell you what the purpose of the Bill of Rights is. So, the conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. And as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. So they were supposed to be further clarification saying, we are only granting you so much power, and these are going to further restrict the power of the government. Okay? So they wanted to make certain that everybody knew they were kind of nailing this down tight. Well, the Bill of Rights that was submitted to the states, there were called 12 articles in them. Okay? Now the first two didn't pass. But the other 10 did. They became our Bill of Rights. But see, you need to understand that this was written in it was published in 1803, and there wasn't a closing end on the time that you could actually ratify an amendment. And that was the problem and concern about stuff like the Equal Rights Amendment and stuff like that, was that if they left it out there for enough years, sooner or later some other states would dribble in and we'd have that amendment. So at this time, 1803, the book wasn't necessarily closed on, there was only 10 Bill of Rights amendments. And so throughout his book, Tucker refers to them in the original order they were sent out to the states in. So when he talks about the 12th article, that was really the 10th amendment. Okay, so you need to kind of remember that. And if I forget to make reference to that when I'm quoting in here and he says the 12th article, just go, oh yeah, that was the 10th amendment, because the first two didn't pass. Okay, so anyway, Tucker seemed to, and the others of the founding era, seemed to really understand that abuse of power was the natural tendency of men. And so what they were trying to do is forestall power seekers from being able to come into the power in the national government and then being able to ultimately usurp and abuse the power of government. And of course, I've got a couple of quotes here I've used probably before with you. Lord Acton, he said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Daniel Defoe, he said, all men would be tyrants if they could. These are pretty universally known tendencies of mankind. These men were not contemporary with the founders, but they understood it. Defoe came before the founders and Acton came after. But it was well understood by across societies that that's the way it was. So anyway, here's what Thomas Jefferson said. He said, in questions of power then, let no more be said of confidence in man, but bind him down for mischief by the change of the Constitution. And I'll quote quite a few of the quotes are a little longer than I usually like to do, but you really need to hear this in their words. I mean, you know how I feel about this. I think we've met together often enough to understand where I'm coming from. I mean, I'm an open book on this kind of stuff. You can predict my response. But you need to hear it in their words, the founding fathers. I think we need to go back and hear their words. So here's what James Madison said about trying to prevent this universal tendency to abuse power. He said, but the great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachments of the others. The provision for defense must, in this, as in all other cases, be made commensurate with the danger of the attack. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections in human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. So what he's saying is, you had to write it into the document. And you had to make it so that they jealously guarded the power, and you had to make it so that because of the nature of man, that they would jealously guard it, because the power of their position depended upon them protecting what had been written in initially. So he also observed, the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may be justly pronounced the very definition of tyranny. So they were very careful to subdivide and keep the powers apart. In a little while, I'm going to talk about something. I wished I had a whiteboard up here drawn, but because sometimes I get talking a picture's worth 1,000 words, and sometimes you'd like that, I know. You'd rather have one little picture instead of me saying 1,000 words. But we don't, so I won't. Now, we're going to talk in a little bit about not only the division of the powers within the different branches of government, but also the divisions of the sources of power. And he talked about that in his book, too. Again, most Americans don't have a clue about this issue of the sources of power being separated so that there would not be an accrual of power that will ultimately lead to tyranny. But we'll go on here. Thomas Jefferson, throughout his writings in many, many places, told similar stories. But here's George Washington. He's said to have warned us that government is not eloquence, it's not reason, it is force, and like fire, it is a dangerous servant and a fearful master. So they really had this true perspective that they tried to capture, and the nation, honestly, was in that mode in the early days. They were far cry from where they are now. Well, he also emphasized in the writing that the state governments retained the undelegated powers. That was critical to realize that the federal government was dependent upon the states for a lot of things. The federal government did not have prominence over the states in one iota. They were considered to be co-equal branches of government, if you will. And it's so interesting to me that he points out that without the states, there couldn't be a Senate. And without the states, there couldn't be a president. And so it's so interesting how we've kind of lost that concept. But he pounded that home. He says, the state governments not only retain every power, jurisdiction, and right not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states, but they constitute and necessary parts of the federal government, and without their agency in their political character, there could be neither a Senate nor President of the United States. So if you think about that, and we'll talk a little bit more in a minute about how presidents become president and senators become senators, at least before the 17th Amendment, and you can see how the states retained a control, a reign, if you will, on the national government. Well, he always, throughout this whole text, he constantly is referring back to the restrictive clause that was the preamble, if you will, to the Bill of Rights. He's constantly reminding us, remember, this is what the Congress said. They're putting additional controls on the national government to restrain it. He does that through the whole book. Well, let me just read you another little statement in here that he makes the legal point that if something is left out, it's left out on purpose. I told you that earlier, but perhaps you need to hear that how he said it, and that you can't imply or construct powers out of things. And we'll use the term construction sometimes. It doesn't mean pounding nails. It means interpreting, okay? Here's what he said. The new government, as in the old, meaning the Articles of Confederation, the general powers are limited, and that the states, in all unenumerated cases, are left in the enjoyment of their sovereign and independent jurisdictions. This construction, or this understanding or interpretation, has been fully confirmed by the 12th Article of Amendments. Now, which one is that? 10. Okay, you guys got the story. Which declares, quote, that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Continuing now with Tucker still. This article was added, quote, to prevent misconstruction or abuse, end quote, of the powers granted by the Constitution rather than supposed necessary to explain and secure the rights of the states or the people. Because what did he just say? He said, we put this in here not to help you understand that the people and the states were really interested in defining their rights, but to tell the national government, you can't miss in that field, my friends. This is, it's off limits, it's off bounds, and you cannot come here and participate in these other areas. They were very explicit in that. So he's saying that basically, well, I'll continue. The powers delegated to the federal government, all being positive and enumerated, according to the ordinary rules of construction, whatever is not enumerated is retained. So again, he's playing this in the reverse of what I just told you about. If we left a right out, would we have lost it? Well, he's saying here in another way, if we didn't give it to you specifically, national government, we retained it. And again, the powers delegated to the federal government being all positive and enumerated, according to the ordinary rules of construction, whatever is not enumerated is retained. If we didn't list it and give it to you in the Constitution, you don't have it, my friend. That's what they felt like at the national government. Okay. So anyway, again, it goes on. By the amendment before mentioned, it is declared that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Thus far, every feature of the Constitution appears to be strictly federal. Okay. Well, he quotes a lot of other contemporary authors throughout this, and among which is the Federalist Papers. Of course, they had been published to help convince the nation that they should, particularly New York, that they should ratify the United States Constitution. And so he goes on to quote them, and sometimes I'll be quoting them as we go on this, through this evening. But he also gave consideration to assure that the sources of power were never allowed to be consolidated. Okay, now, here's the deal. We know that they divided the assignments, and so that one would be a check on the other. The Congress would pass a law, well, the House would pass a law, which would then go to the Senate, and the Senate would have to review it to make sure that it was deliberated on and that we haven't asked for the states to provide money for things that we don't want the states to, because the senators were basically beholden to the states, and they knew they'd lose their job if they did something stupid because they were going to have to come back to the states to ask for the money, right? Okay. So anyway, we know all about those things. So the Congress and the Senate kind of checked each other. Then when the Senate and Congress and the House had come together, the President had a check on them, and they had a check on the President, and we could go back and forth for a while. But a lot of people don't understand that the sources of power were also checks and balances. Now, in the original United States Constitution, the source of the power of the House of Representatives was the people. And consequently, there's an inverse relationship. You know you're going to learn math tonight, did you? There's an inverse relationship between power and the length of time that you're in office. That's the way they established it. So what that means is, if you are perceived to have the most power, you have a shortest term in office. Okay? It's kind of interesting. They wanted to keep a closer check on those that could potentially do more damage. And so what they did, well, why was the House so powerful? Two things. It was closest to the people. They could go out and appeal directly to the people and say, you know, rally to me and I'll make sure you get your cause through this thing. And the people could get, you know, pretty worked up about things. And sometimes some of these demagogues of different types can rile the people up pretty much in the mob psychology. So the people were the ones that were the source of the power for the House of Representatives. And because it was the people's money, they give the House the power of the purse. So the House not only had the people behind them, but they could spend, you know, begin the bills to spend the money. Of course, the Senate could amend them later. If something that was going to spend money came through the House and was passed, got to the Senate, they could, of course, amend it and then send it back to the House to ratify their amendment. But the point of the matter is, 2 years in the House because they had the most power. That was their perception. They wanted them to come up for election more often. Okay? What was the source of power for the Senate before the 17th Amendment? The states. The states were the ones that chose the senators. That kept the states in the national loop. So they were able to pull a check and a balance on something that might start happening at that level. Well, and of course, the senators were supposed to be more deliberative and more mature. The age difference that they required for those to become senators and everything entered into that. They needed to have a more mature view on life and all that kind of stuff. They were to be kind of a settling point for the hot-headedness, if you will, of the House of Representatives. So the Senate looked to the states for their power. And they had over 60 ballots trying to figure out how in the world are we going to... What's the source of power for the president? Well, the people ought to elect him. No. Then you'll be consolidating power. Well, the states ought to. No. You'll be consolidating power. They went round and around over that. They had over 60 ballots in the Constitutional Convention of 1787 to try and determine how they would elect the president. And finally, you know, when you say, well, let's have the House and the Senate do it, well, then the president is beholden to him. And he's put together a consortium behind him, and he's always looking over his shoulder saying, am I doing okay, you guys? And the guys are back there pulling the strings and saying to the president, no, here's what you need to do. He wouldn't be his own man. He wouldn't be that check. So they went back and forth about this. How do we take care of this? But there's got to be some deliberative process, and we've got to pick somebody that's noble enough to sit in that office. Of course, they knew when they were writing the Constitution that George Washington would be the first guy that would hold the office. Everybody just knew that. But they knew that there would be subsequent men. And by the way, I think I've mentioned this before for some of you. There were four things that Thomas Jefferson was very concerned about when he first read the Constitution. Now, you know that he was in Paris as the U.S. ambassador, if you will, to France when the Constitution was being written. Now, he and James Madison had corresponded heavily, and he had forwarded a lot of great books to James Madison. But he was not present at the convention. And so as soon as they get out of there, I can see one of those guys dashing him off a note and sending him a copy of the Constitution. He was appalled. There were four problems. One of them didn't have a Bill of Rights. And the second one was that there was not an absolute protection of the trial by jury, because they absolutely, unequivocally considered the trial by jury to be the second to the last, if you will, safeguard for liberty. And I would say the last one would be the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. So they had no Bill of Rights, no right to trial by jury. Now, those were taken care of with the Bill of Rights, because we got that in there. And I told you before, I think, too, that the Patriot Act, in some instances, will not allow any more the trial by jury when things come to trial. But this was something the Founding Fathers were adamant about, because you could try both the law and the fact in front of the jury. And the jury could say, if something, even if the law said something and the person had done it, they could still say, we're letting them go, because the law, in this case, would be applied without justice. Didn't get rid of all the law that law had, and it wouldn't, you know, say it doesn't exist anymore. It would just say, in this particular case, it's out of business. We don't do it. But the other two things, one was the reelectability of the president. He says, now, the guy that's going to have it first is not going to be a concern. We know he's got honor, and he is not a tyrant. And we talked about that last time, what the George Washington was one of those guys that kind of tried to deflect power away from himself. And so he says, but someday it's going to become a problem. The reelectability of the president. Now, George Washington served two terms. He left of his own volition, made a good choice. Everybody else honored that. And until we got a guy in the mid-40s that kind of liked it, and so he hung around until he died in office after being elected four times. But that got fixed after that with an amendment to the Constitution. But the fourth thing that bothered him was the reelectability of senators. He felt that that was absolutely going to become a problem. And today we see that that's basically an office for life. For those that want to stay there, do stay there. And they're there for, you know, as many terms as they want to stay in their 6-year terms. So anyway, that was a concern to Jefferson. And all of them have been taken care of except for the fourth one. And I'm not so sure the fourth one needs to be taken care of if the electorate would become informed and awakened and aroused to their duty to be able to continue to have good servants there. Now, people say, well, if we had term limits, we'd throw the bums out. Well, there's always another socialist waiting in the wings to step in. I mean, trust me, that's just the way it is now. So the electorate has got to recognize good government from bad and be able to take appropriate action. So anyway, why? It's 8:00 already. We may not get through this whole thing tonight, but there's a couple of things. Don't let me leave without talking to you about the war powers that he talked about and the necessity of arms for preserving liberty. So those are two things, and they're towards the end. And if it looks like it's getting tired, I'll maybe say, okay, we're going to wrap it up for tonight, and you guys read the book, and you can get your own stuff out of it. But anyway, but those are two things I want to talk about for sure. But we've talked about where the people got the power. I mean, the people gave the power to the Congress, the states gave the power to the Senate, and this presidential thing was a sticky wicket kind of thing. And what they ended up doing is they said, you know, we need a deliberative body. We need one that's of honorable people. But we don't want any standing obligations there that the president's always looking over his shoulder and seeing if this group's still giving him his approval. So they came up with this idea of Electoral College. And the Electoral College basically was an idea that said, we will hire or elect a special legislative body that has one task and one only. And as soon as they complete that task, they're dissolved and they go back to being civilians. Or more modern terminology I'm using here. But so they knew that they would probably have people that would be put forward to be president. And not everybody would be able to know everybody else, because they might be regional presidents, somebody from the South or somebody from New England or somebody from the Middle States or something like that. And this deliberative body needed to take a look at all these men and say, you know what, this one is of the caliber that we need to lead this nation. And then they would together agree that that individual was the chosen one, if you will, for being the president. Of course, we've corrupted that with the party process. We've corrupted that with the way the Electoral College works in the states, winner take all, and I think we may have visited about that at one point in one of our meetings. But that was the idea. The source of power for the president should be brought together for one purpose and then dissolved. And so the president stood on his own feet after that. Okay. So those sources of power were a very, very important thing. And yes, sir? It could. It's the only thing. There were names brought forth very often from regions. Okay, now, like for example, Joseph Smith in 1844 was running for president. And there would have been someone bring his forth his name to this group. And what had happened just before his martyrdom was that the 12 apostles were out fostering his position. And if you haven't read yet his position on government, you ought to. And we've talked a little bit about that, I think, before. And it's a great pamphlet to get a hold of. But they were out and they were using that as a tract. And there's a very high probability that he would have been elected president, by the way. And the reason was because there wasn't a big effort to elect people all across the nation. And he had representatives, if you will, in the 12 apostles that were scattered throughout the country. And they were fostering these things. And I have letters in my files that up to about 8 or 9 days before his martyrdom that were extremely glowing in the response that was being given by very prominent people across the nation. Okay, so these people would bring the name to the convention or the electoral college and say, he's our man. Now, this really only worked for a very short period of time because it started to get, kind of the campaign element a little bit. Although Jefferson didn't campaign, there were people that were campaigning on his behalf. And Jefferson and Burr basically tied in the electoral college, and they tied 30-some-odd times, 33 or 36, I can't remember, in the House. And finally, the election was thrown to Jefferson, and Burr came within a gnat's eyelash of being our third president. He became a vice president at that time. But anyway, the Electoral College did their job, went away, and that was how they divided the power sources. Okay. Well, let's see. Tucker was constantly reminding the readers that the states retained their sovereign nature and powers in their realms. And he says, an example in this one quote I've got here, the government cannot be deemed a national one since its jurisdiction extends to certain enumerated objects only and leaves to the several states a residuary and inviolable sovereignty over all other objects. So where we have senators or congressmen that are bringing forth, as has been done so many cases in the last few decades, where I think of the Crime Bill of 1993 that Senator Hatch fostered. He was the prime directive, if you will, on this one. That crime bill caused, if it had passed, but it was later rolled into the Omnibus Crime Bill of 1994, and so most of these things passed. It had a lot of things like, for example, of confiscation of private property, and the agency that confiscated the property ended up being able to retain the property as part of their budget, if you will, after it was sold. Some domestic crimes, and by domestic I don't mean like foreign, international, and United States, but I mean spouse abuse, rape. Some of those things were given federal jurisdiction over. Absolutely, completely foreign to what the Founding Fathers thought. And what Tucker says here is basically that if we didn't enumerate these things and give them to the national government, the national government can't even mess in that arena. So, all right. Quoting again, the authority of the federal government extends are few, definitive, and enumerated, and are all carved out of the sovereign authority. Otherwise, the gradual and sometimes imperceptible usurpations of power will end in the total disregard of all its intended limitations. So you just want us to remember, we carved out some, we gave it to you, don't go anywhere else. Here's what Jefferson said. It has long been my opinion, and I have never shrunk from its expression, although I do not choose to put it in the newspaper, that the germ of dissolution of our federal government is in the constitution of the federal judiciary, an irresponsible body. For impeachment is scarcely a scarecrow, working like gravity by night and by day, gaining a little today and a little tomorrow, and advancing its noiseless step like a thief over the field of jurisdiction, until all shall be usurped from the states, and the government of all be consolidated into one. To this I am opposed, because when all government, domestic and foreign, in little as in great things, shall be drawn to Washington as the center of all power, it will render powerless checks provided of one government on another and will become as venal and oppressive as the government from which we are separated. So he was worried, particularly about the judiciary at that time, that there would be a gradual consolidation of power and to the point that it had become as bad or worse than what the government that they had had their rebellion over. Washington said, "Resist with care the spirit of innovation upon its principles." He's speaking of the Constitution. "However specious the pretext, one method of assault may be to effect in the forms of the Constitution alterations which will impair the energy of the system and thus to undermine what cannot be directly overthrown. Liberty itself will find in such a government, with powers properly distributed and adjusted, its surest guardian. It is indeed little else than a name where the government is too feeble to withstand the enterprises of faction, to confine each member of the society within the limits prescribed by the laws, and to maintain in all the secure and tranquil enjoyment of the rights of person and property." So he's basically saying, don't go there. It may sound like a really good reason when you're going to do this, to step away from these checks and balances and these constraints, these limits on the national government, but don't do it, because it will ultimately impair the energy of the system and undermine that which cannot be directly overthrown. See, he was firmly convinced that if we were allowed to live under the Constitution the way it was written, that it couldn't be destroyed by a fight in terms of battles and stuff like that. But if we kind of chip away at it and whittle away at it and kind of undermine it and erode it and whatever by these little adjustments that we make for the convenience of whatever, Patriot Act's a horrible example. It's a good example of a horrible example, I guess I should say, of these kind of things, where we're constantly just, with a dull saw maybe, we're cutting down the tree. So, anyway, now let's talk for just a minute about a written constitution. The value of a written constitution is beyond measure. The words have meanings, and those meanings can be known. They are not open to arbitrary, unilateral interpretation. They just cannot be redefined. If we do not have an understanding of what those words are, or somebody convinces us to change the meaning of those words, we've got to the point where we're not going to have a constitution. And I've got another, it's not in this paper here, but Jefferson defined what could be termed original intent. And a lot of people today say, oh my goodness, how could you know what those guys meant? So what's with you guys that keep saying, let's go back to the original intent. Let's go back to the tradition of the founding fathers. I mean, it's a living document, for goodness sakes. And it adjusts to our needs today. You know how insidious that is? If the words can have any meaning that you want to give to them, it means that they have no meaning at all, and we won't have a constitution at all. But when Jefferson kind of gathered the reins of the presidency to himself as he was first elected, this is what he said. "The Constitution on which our Union rests shall be administered by me according to the safe and honest meaning contemplated by the plain understanding of the people of the United States at the time of its adoption. A meaning to be found in the explanations of those who advocated, not those who opposed it. These explanations are preserved in the publications of the time." See, so if we're willing to go back and read the publications, you say, oh yeah, they really did mean limited government, didn't they? They really did mean the Congress did this, and the Senate did that, and the President did this, and the courts did that, and there is no other way. Well, James Wilson, he played a very prominent role in the Constitution Convention, and he later became a Supreme Court Justice. Here's what he said. "The first and governing maxim in the interpretation of a statute is to discover the meaning of those who made it." So that's our duty. And we can go back, we can read those words, and by golly, we can understand them. Here's what Chief Justice Marshall said. He was a very prominent individual. Of course, he played the role as a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court for many, many years. And he played a prominent role in the Virginia Ratifying Convention. So when he spoke to that convention, he says, "If a word was understood in a particular way when the Constitution was framed, the Constitutional Convention must have used it in that sense." So when I try to look for understanding, and let's say a word may have changed in its meaning, and I go back to the 1828 Noah Webster Dictionary, which was the first unabridged, if you will, American dictionary. Noah Webster was one of the founding fathers, And he wrote very clearly and specifically what the definitions were. Coining money, anything in there. It's a far different thing than running the printing presses day and night. So anyway, probably I've spent a little more time on that than I needed to. But the point of the matter is, the written Constitution is extremely valuable to us, and it can only be modified one way, legally. And that's by the Article 5 process, which is defined in the Constitution and tells us, if you're going to change it, and the founders thought that, yeah, maybe we overlooked stuff, maybe it's not perfect, maybe things will come up, we've got a way to change it. And it's a very deliberative process. It's not you wave a magic wand and pass it through Congress. It's not you get a very supermajority there. It's not that you start practicing something different based upon an executive order or a judicial decree. It's a very defined process. Yes, Clark. Can you hold that thing about the treaty for just a minute? Because we're going to talk about that in a minute. Treaties are very definitely considered to be a way of changing the Constitution by some people. And they're absolutely not the way to change the Constitution. They have no authority to do so. And the Founding Fathers understood that. And there's been efforts over the years to put, back in the 50s, there was a Bricker Amendment. Some of you may have heard of that. There's a number of different versions out there. The Bricker Amendment, in my opinion, is not the good best solution. You can look up on the internet and find the Bricker Amendment. You can find a few different versions of what the wording sounds like. But basically, the Bricker Amendment, to me, as I read it, sounds almost like the Soviet Constitution. Okay? You shall not change the Constitution by treaty unless modified by law. Or allowed by law, or something. I don't have the exact words today, but the fact is that it's kind of gives some wiggle room in there that I say, no, let's nail this puppy down. People need to understand that this was never the intention of the Founding Fathers. If we had treaties, modify the Constitution, what does it take to ratify a treaty? It takes 2/3 of the Senate, doesn't it, after the President's made the agreement. So why do we have this onerous task that's outlined in the Article 5 process of how we get this through both houses and then we send them out to the states and the states have to do by convention or ratifying process otherwise to come back and change the Constitution. If the President and 2/3 of the Congress or the Senate can get together and change it, does this make any sense? But we'll talk a little bit about what the Founding Fathers said in just a minute. Well, there are many people that consider the Supreme Court to be a constantly sitting Constitutional Convention. And some believe that a decree by a president or by the Congress or whatever can change the Constitution. And maybe they don't even overtly think about that so much now because they just change it without even recognizing that they have a Constitution they're violating. And when they do things, and we'll talk in a few minutes about delegation of power. I see some young people here. If I can keep them awake for a while, if they're basketball fans, I may bring some of them up here in a minute. But be thinking about basketball for a minute, girls. Maybe you girls aren't the best ones to ask. But there's a little guy there, too. Anyway, we're going to talk about delegation of power and how differently it is understood today than what it was understood in their day, in the founders' day, and how even a small child today can understand delegation of power and why it can't be redelegated. But we'll get to that in a minute. But Tucker viewed the United States Constitution as a written contract. It was the original contract with America, if you will. And that nonsense that Newt Gingrich and his buddies came up with in the mid-1900s was a farce. It was a social program that was an agenda to pass things through the Congress that should never have been given the light of day constitutionally. But Tucker and others, well, here's what Tucker said. It is a written contract. Government was reduced to its elements. Its objective was defined, its principles ascertained, its powers limited and fixed. This guy was an attorney. He wanted to tie it down real tight, you know? Okay. So here's what Jefferson said, and we're going to get into the treaties now a little bit. Jefferson said, when an instrument permits two constructions, remember we said that could be interpretations, the one safe and the other dangerous, the one precise, the other indefinite. I prefer that which is safe and precise. I had rather ask an enlargement of power from the nation where it is found necessary than to assume it by a construction which would make our powers boundless. Our particular security is in the possession of a written constitution. Let us not make it a blank paper by construction. I say the same as to the opinion of those who consider the grant of treaty-making power as boundless. If it is, then we have no constitution. If it has bounds, they can be no others than the definitions of the powers which that instrument gives. It specifies and delineates the operations permitted to the federal government and gives all the powers necessary to carry these into execution. Whatever of these enumerated objects is proper for a law, Congress may make a law. Whatever is proper to be executed by way of a treaty, the President and Senate may enter into the treaty. Whatever is to be done by a judicial sentence, the judges may pass the sentence. So he's saying, keep it in the balance. It's defined within the Constitution, for goodness sakes. You can't change the Constitution by doing a process that's different than the Article 5 process. Well, Tucker talked about written contract and the construction and usurpations weren't allowed. He made note of the jealousy and the regard of the states and the people had of their rights and the powers and their sovereignty. So he goes again into the 10th Amendment. He says, the powers not it was the 12th article, by the way, remember with him. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states or reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And still further, to guard the people against constructive usurpations and encroachments on their rights, another article declares that the enumeration of certain rights in the Constitution shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. The sum of all which appears to be that the powers delegated to the federal government are in all cases to receive the most strict construction that the instrument will bear, where the rights of a state or the people, either collectively or individually, may be drawn into question. So, unequivocal. Now, during the debates, Virginia played the ratification of the Constitution originally. Virginia had probably one of the most arduous discussions by some of the most brilliant minds of the day about what ought to be there. And so Tucker included some of those debates in his writings to help the people know what kind of process the people were thinking of when they created this Bill of Rights. And so this came out of the Virginia debates, and Tucker included it. He says, every power not granted hereby remains with them and at their will, that therefore no right of any denomination can be canceled, abridged, restrained, or modified by the Congress, by the Senate, or the House of Representatives, acting in any capacity by the President or any department or office of the United States, except in those instances where power is given by the Constitution for those purposes, that among other essential rights, the liberty of conscience and of the press cannot be canceled, abridged, restrained, or modified by any authority of the United States. I mean, he just tried to tie it down so tight. He looked at it kind of as a binding compact. And, you know, and there's numerous locations he says. I'll just quote another little one here about the national government and the limits of power. He says, having no existence but under the Constitution, nor any rights but such as that instrument confers, and those very rights being in fact duties, it can possess no legitimate power but such as is absolutely necessary for the performance of a duty prescribed and enjoined by the Constitution. Its duties then become the exact measure of its powers. And wherever it exerts a power for any other purpose than the performance of a duty prescribed by the Constitution, it transgresses its proper limits and violates the public trust. So then he talks somewhat about oaths of office and the solemn oath that those take that uphold the Constitution. He makes a big ado about sovereignty of the states. And here again he says, and this Constitution, as we have already had occasion to remark, is now confirmed by the subsequent amendments to the Constitution, Article 12. The right of sovereignty, therefore, is in all cases not expressly seceded. Let me re-quote that last part of the sentence. The right of sovereignty, therefore, in all cases not expressly ceded to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the several states, remains inviolably with the states respectively. Okay, so, and he talked a little bit about the dividing and subdividing of power, and he talks about controlling that power, and it's a common malady that the Congress faces today. Yes, sir. Okay, well, let's do that here, because I'll tell you the truth. I've got more information here than you guys maybe have time to hear. Well, okay, I'll jump to that right now. We've talked about how he really specifically, exactly, and directly ties everything back to the Constitution, and how it is what the Constitution said is binding upon all those that within the nation. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the United States Constitution says that Congress shall have power to declare war. Okay. Well, the Founding Fathers let me first read you what Tucker says. He was absolutely adamant that the power to declare war rested solely with Congress. There was no other wiggle room whatsoever, and he's very explicit about that. The executive does not have a shred of authority to bind this nation and bring us into war. And here's what he said, then I'll kind of explain it a little bit. This is quoting Tucker. The power declaring war, with all its train of consequences, direct and indirect, forms the next branch of the powers confided to Congress. And happy it is for the people of America that it is so vested. The term war embraces the extremes of human misery and iniquity, and is alike the offspring of the one and the parent of the other. What else is the history of war from the earliest ages to the present moment but an afflicting detail of the suffering and calumnies of mankind, resulting from the ambition, usurpation, animosities, resentments, piques, intrigues, avarice, rapacity, oppressions, murders, assassinations, and other crimes of the few possessing power? How rare are the instances of a just war? How few of those which are thus denominated have had their existence in national injury? The personal claims of the sovereign are confounded with the interests of the nation over which he presides, and his private grievances or complaints are transferred to the people, who are thus made the victims of a quarrel in which they have no part, until they become the principals in it by their sufferings. War should be banished from the face of the earth, war would be banished from the face of the earth were nations, instead of princes, to decide upon their necessity. Injustice can never be the collective sentiment of a people emerged from barbarism. Happy the nation where the people are the arbiters of their own interest and their own conduct. Happy were it for the world did the people of all nations possess this power. Okay, so, I mean, very eloquently, very succinctly, very powerfully, very unequivocally, he nails this thing down and says, it's only Congress. And the guy that's at the head of the country has no right or responsibility. The founders had personally experienced this. They had seen that the war was brought upon nations generally by a sovereign, that through some pique of or fit of anger or whatever, brought their nation and slaughtered their people, spending their treasury. And reading Jefferson's writings, it is just one commentary after another of the foolishness that was swept back and forth across Europe. And of course, one of the things that really is of point is the Bonaparte's wars and how he slaughtered so many hundreds of thousands of people. Well, anyway, they felt like it was critically important to avoid war unless it was thrust upon them by an aggressor which sought to destroy their lives, their liberties, their families, and all that was just and true. Yes, sir.
Right.
You know, I'll address that in more detail right now if you'd like me to, because there, that is an absolute truism. It's a tragedy what's happened. But let me just do we have a young person in here that's a basketball fan? I mean, just a little person. Anybody here? Does he know basketball good enough to own the Jazz or anything like that? Okay. Well, I'll just tell the story. I like to bring like a 10-year-old up. You know, a 10-year-old. I like people to see that a 10-year-old can understand this principle. We don't need to have a law degree, and we don't need to be a senator or a congressman or a president to understand this. A 10-year-old can. Here's how I tell the story normally. I'll bring the young person up, and I say, so you like basketball, huh? Yeah, I do. You like the Jazz? Oh, yeah. Who's your favorite player? And they'll pick somebody. Doesn't matter who, because they all make millions of dollars. That's all I want is somebody that's making big bucks and plays basketball good, compared to me anyway. And I say, well, who owns the Jazz? Well, Larry Miller. Oh. Well, this basketball player of yours, he's pretty good, isn't he? Oh, yeah. Hmm. Let's say this guy got tired of doing his job, playing basketball. But he still liked the money. I mean, you make millions of dollars off of this, and my goodness, it's hard to turn your back on that. And so he came to me, a guy in his mid-50s, said, hey, why don't you take my place on the court? Why don't you go play for me? And Larry's going to keep paying me, and I'll pay you a little bit, but you get to play pro ball. And I go, wow, that's cool. Okay, I'll go play basketball for the Jazz. Well, first time I show up suited up and on the court, what's Larry Miller going to say? He probably can't be printed. But at any rate, Larry Miller, rightfully, is going to wonder about a broken down 55-year-old that's out playing basketball in the place of some guy that he's paying multi-million dollars to do the job. So what's he going to do? He's going to say, can't do it. See, he delegated to that player the right to play basketball. He didn't delegate it to me. Okay? And he has a right to pull that back and say, this is not going to happen. So even a 10-year-old can understand that. You can have a 10-year-old standing up here and he can know that's just not going to happen. Well, oddly enough, not oddly enough, truthfully enough, I guess I should say, that the power of delegation cannot be delegated once it has been delegated once in a free country under a constitution. The founding fathers had studied John Locke, for example, in the second treatise on government. He had written a review about some of the constitutional protocol. And I can probably quote it here if we give me a second here. He said, and this is a direct quote from John Locke's second essay concerning civil government. The legislative cannot transfer the power of making laws to any other hands, for it being but a delegated power from the people, they who have it cannot pass it over to others. The people alone can appoint the form of the commonwealth, which is by constituting the legislative and appointing in whose hands that shall be. And when the people have said, we will submit and be governed by laws made by such man in such forms, nobody else can say, other men shall make laws for them. Nor can they be bound by any laws but such as are enacted by those whom they have chosen and authorized to make their laws for them. See, we hired them to play basketball for us. That's their job. They can't give it to another guy. Okay? And that was John Locke's understanding and what he promoted. That was what the founding fathers understood. And by the way, Tucker agreed with him. He said, the delegated authority cannot be transferred to another to exercise. That's what Tucker said, by the way. Yes, sir. Correct. Absolutely. That was their intention, and it was unequivocal. And by the way, those of you that, I could show you if you're interested later. I've got it up here in my little black briefcase. The resolution wherein Congress supposedly delegated their authority to go to war to the president. The resolution mentions the United Nations or Security Council or the United Nations resolution more than 36 times. They mention the United States Constitution twice, both in error, falsely, I guess I should say, in that they say the Constitution allows this. Completely a fabrication. There's not a shred of anything constitutional in what they used to delegate to the United States President the authority to go to war. The people said, and it was declared by an authenticated act of the people when it was ratified, Congress shall have power to declare war. And as Locke said, and as Tucker agreed, once that power has been delegated, that cannot be delegated again. So, complete falsehood under which we're operating right now. Yes, sir? Yes. Thank you. That's a very good point. Let me talk about that for just a second. It doesn't just apply to war, people. Where we delegate to some other body, some authority, it cannot be done so constitutionally. And it's a complete fabrication in that's been foisted upon the people and the United Nations thing since 1945. But you look at GATT and NAFTA and World Trade Organization and the CAFTA and the future free trade area of the Americas. What happens? What does Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution say? It says that the Congress is the one that is going to regulate foreign commerce. Okay? Well, when you turn it over to the World Trade Organization or to CAFTA or NAFTA or whoever, the alphabet soups that are out there, what you're doing is you're saying, I, as Congress, that was hired to play basketball for this team, is delegating to a second stringer over here someplace my authority to play. And that is not protocol constitutionally. So, yeah, constitutionally, the United Nations is operating in something in an area where we, the Congress and the President and those others, cannot give them authority to act on our behalf because we did not ratify that as a free people. Okay? So you can take anything you want that way. I mean, how can they delegate to some organization the fulfilling of some usurped power that some alphabet soup organization that was not created fully and legally by the Congress, you know, they didn't pass a law, they just wrote the law themselves, and now they've usurped that to themselves. We shouldn't be bound by those. It's really, really an upside-down system right now. We've strayed so far, it's tragic, because those checks and balances are so critical. And as Jefferson said, it'll someday become as venal and oppressive is the government that we came away from. Well, often, getting back to war for a second, the whim of the monarch was basically the sole factor in squandering the lives, the fortunes, and the sacred honor of the people. And the founders wished to prevent such conditions, and they knew the burdens of war firsthand, so they tried to shield their posterity from those sufferings wherever they could. And so they built the greatest of protections they possibly could into this by placing it in the hands of the group that was closest to the people, because they were the people would be the ones that would pay the heaviest price. They wanted it to be as deliberative as possible. Now think for a minute about this war that we've entered, that we're in currently. What kind of deliberation did it get? Apparently not enough, because somehow, some way, somewhere, they overlooked the fact that all these things that we said were the reasons to go to war weren't really there. Okay. It's a tragedy. And you know, you talk about the 2,300 or 2,500 of our brave soldiers, sailors, marines, and airmen that have died in this thing. And about 9 or 10 to 1 is what the ratio is now. There's some in the audience here that are old enough perhaps to remember World War II. On the World War II's battles, we had one death for every 3 wounded. It was a very, I mean, we just didn't have the means. I mean, the fog of war, the brutality of it, the immensity of it, and the medical technology and all those kinds of things were not adequate to be able to save many more than that. If you got hit on Iwo Jima, there's a very high likelihood that you were probably going to die where you were, because we just couldn't medevac you, didn't have the technology. There was many that were miraculously saved, obviously, but it was about 3 to 1. For years after that, Korea got a little bit better, then it became 4 to 1 in Vietnam and 5 to 1. And now it's 8, 9, or 10 to 1, the wounded to deaths. And so we've got a, you know, we've lost 2,500. I don't know what the number is exactly right now, but multiply that, and you'll see about how many have been wounded. Many of these are, have, about 60% of them have severe brain damage. Okay, now, in other battlefields, they would have died on the battlefield. I served 36 years ago, and I have known men that probably should have died on the battlefield then. I don't know why they were preserved. But their quality of life is pretty miserable. But the point is, many of these are multiple amputees. So you talk about the number killed, but for a loved one to be able to sit in a hospital room with a ventilator keeping their loved one alive and hold their hand when that's the only thing they've got, I'm not so sure that's a lot better option. So, I mean, well, I'm probably spending more time on this than I should be, but the fact of the matter is that the price of these things is very severe. And it needs to be thought of very carefully. There needs to be a deliberative process. And when it's just, when it's right, and it has to be done, that's when it will be done. But when it's done by the prerogative of the sovereign emperor, or the prince, or whatever you want to call him, that's going the way that the founders were definitely against. So the House of Representatives is the only department that was directly related to the people. Senate would ultimately have to pay for it. That's what they thought about, so they will put the Congress in charge of this. They specifically withheld the power from the President of the United States. Congress is the only one that has the power to go to war constitutionally. Now, we have not been in a constitutionally declared war since the 1940s, when Congress last declared one. So we're a far cry from what we should be. So that's a challenge that we have today. Any questions or comments about that in regards to... Yes, sir, turn in the very back. Well, you probably all heard the question, are we going to go invade Colombia because they're clear and present danger? How many saw that movie? I like that movie. He talked about it was a serious crime to do computer hacking, and he says, yeah, it's a serious crime to, you know, what did he say, to violate the Constitution too or something like that. I mean, there was a couple of good lines in that one. Go see the movie if you haven't yet. It's kind of one of those Jack Ryan ones. The what? Clear and Present Danger. It's a Tom Clancy, it's a book that was made into a movie, and it's kind of like The Hunt for Red October and some of those that were kind of interesting. You had a comment, sir? Unfortunately, what you're saying is absolutely true. And even more unfortunately is the fact that Americans care so little at this point. Every morning my wife and I go down to work out at a gym. And there's a guy that was on the high council with me that is there sometimes. He doesn't come every morning, but he was there this morning. And he made a comment to Tammy this morning at the gym. He says, why does your husband care so much about this stuff? I mean, he says, I'm just bored to death when I think about these things. And you know, there's a great line, a couple of great lines. They're out of a movie, okay. But I got to read them to you. That makes me think about a couple of these things. And I know they're movies, okay? And they really probably, there was no scribe there writing this down. But they are so moving, I think. Braveheart. If you haven't seen Braveheart, get the edited version if you don't want to see an R-rated movie. And there's plenty of blood in it anyway, I guess. William Wallace, before the Battle of Stirling, you know, he's in front of the troops on his horse. You know, they're ready to scatter. They're, you know, the king sent his, you know, troops in armor and well, you know, financed as well as armed and everything. And the people are sitting there with their pitchforks and some sharp sticks, basically, and stuff like that. And William Wallace says, I am William Wallace, and I see a whole army of my countrymen here in defiance of tyranny. You have come to fight as free men, and free men you are. What will you do with freedom? Will you fight? 2,000 against 10? A veteran shouted, no, we'll run and live. Yes, Wallace shouted back, fight and you may die. Run and you may live, at least a while. and dying in your bed many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that one for a chance to come back here as young men and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they will never take our freedom? And then, remember, maybe nobody has seen the movie, but maybe I'm just introducing something to you that might intrigue you. I don't know. William the Bruce was royalty, of royal descent there. And William Wallace was a common man. Quite an interesting story behind the man. By the way, and I'll tell you, if you have seen the movie, there's a princess in there, a French princess. And my wife didn't like the movie because of that very reason. This princess was so beautiful and alluring, and Wallace had lost his wife, and she ends up being his very good friend. But that really irritated my wife that he wasn't faithful to her memory. The princess was not on the scene until after Wallace was dead. Okay, so you can watch the movie without having to worry about it. It was a love interest that wasn't really there. But at any rate, here's what the conversation that happens in the movie between Robert the Bruce and William Wallace. He says, William Wallace, "There is a difference between us," Wallace said in quiet fervor. "You think the people of this country exist to provide you with position. I think your position exists to provide the people with freedom, and I go to make sure that they have it." "You despise us," Robert said. "I can't blame you. I've heard what you've been through, but remember, my brave friend, these men," meaning the ones that are holding back, "have lands, castles, much to risk. And the common man who bleeds on the battlefield, does he risk less?" Wallace asked. "Your title gives you claim to the throne of our country," Wallace said. "But men don't follow titles. They follow courage. Your arm speaks louder than your tongue. Our people know you, noble and common. They respect you. If you would lead them toward freedom, they would follow you. And so would I." And he's going, "Whoa. Just step up to your job, man." And then this one with the princess. And then I'll put away my Braveheart stuff. But while the princess reminded William Wallace of everything he had loved and lost, he haunted her with everything she wanted and had never found. Tall, powerful, commanding, his shoulders thick, his hair wild, his eyes soft, even pained. This is Mel Gibson writing this, of course, because he was Braveheart. A man facing the hatred of the world's most powerful king, a man who had won great battles and commanded armies, yet who looked as if he could spur his horse away right now and ride away from adoration and glory and never miss any of it. She had never seen a man like this. She had never known such a one existed. "The king proposes that you withdraw your attack. In return, he grants you hereditary title, estates, and this chest with 1,000 pounds of gold, which I am to pay to you personally. A lordship and gold, that I should become Judas. Peace is made in such ways. Slaves are made in such ways." It's a good movie. You ought to see it. But anyway, it conveys the message. The point I wanted to make with that, though, is you ask about what will it take? I mean, there's got to be some leadership somewhere. I mean, as you point out, the newspapers are very remiss at best in being able to report this constitutional things that are in such violation. The population, generally and largely, is apathetic at best, sleeping, probably. And like this friend that talked to Tammy this morning and said, it bores me to death to think about these things. But honestly, these things are at the core of everything we hold sacred. Do you love your family? Of course you do. Do you want to support and sustain them? Absolutely. Do you want your children and wives to be peaceful and safe? Do you want to be able to have them know truth? Do you want them to be able to receive the gospel of Jesus Christ and be able to worship God according to their dictates of their conscience? Do you want them to be able to practice their religion? Do you want to be able to take the truth to the world? Do you want to give a hope to the rest? I mean, you could ask the question after question after question, and the answer in my mind is always yes. We need to have liberty in order that we might have those other things. So this friend of mine that wants to, he kind of commented to Tammy that he never kind of grew out of high school. He likes the basketball and the football more than he likes these other things, but he still likes them. And that's okay with me. I don't care. But somewhere, somehow, there's got to be a core, a remnant that loves these things enough to try and stand for them. And I guess that's one of the reasons I keep coming back, and I don't know why you have me sometimes, is that because I love to be with people that love these things, and I like to try and foster them. But liberty really burns in the hearts of the people. A lot of times they just don't know it. And somehow we've got to help them be exposed to it again and be able to again embrace it. And have I told you the story about, you know, we put on the Constitution commemoration every year up in Cache Valley. Have I told you the story about what happened one time when we'd got done with it and I was just going to eat lunch for the first time in months, it seemed like, the Monday after we got done? Did I tell? I'll tell the story in case I haven't. It's a very hectic thing for us to try and put on the commemoration. We kind of feel like a one-man band. Tammy probably works 16 or 18 hours a day and for months and doesn't sleep at night because of it. I only get to work about 6 or 7 hours a day on it because I have to work too, but I don't sleep at night either. So it's a very, very challenging time for us. And finally it's over. We finish on Saturday night usually, and we strike the set on the pageant and everything, and we take everything back to the storage shed, and then, of course, you got to use the next few weeks in doing the laundry of the costumes and everything like that. But we don't have the pressure of the deadline. So that Monday, right after this pageant, I went to lunch, and I just sat down in the restaurant, and I hadn't just sat down, but I had my food, and I was ready to dig in with my fork. I'd picked up my fork, and I was ready to dig in, and I perceived somebody standing by me. And I could tell it was a woman from the side, and I kind of looked up, and she says, "We got to talk." "Yes, ma'am." I set my fork down and said, "Sit down if you'd like." And she sat down and she said, "I went to your pageant." I said, "Oh, did you like it?" She said, "Something happened." I said, "What do you mean something happened?" She said, "Something happened, and I want to know what." I said, "Well, tell me about it." She said, "I brought my father, who was a World War II veteran, and he sat next to me." She said, "I had my youngest son, who was 17, and he sat next to me on this other side." And she said, "I looked at my father, and he was sobbing. He was crying. I've never seen my father cry, and he was crying. I looked over at my son, and he was crying. And I realized I was crying." She said, "What happened?" I said, "Did you feel something in here?" She said, "Yeah, what was it?" I said, "That's the cause of liberty. You felt that, didn't you?" She said, "Yes." Then she said something I didn't quite have an answer for. She said, "What do I do now?" And, oh, man, it's like, we've got to do something. And we've got to somehow get this people again at the point where they recognize that cause of liberty in their hearts. It's a small group here tonight. And you know what, Tamara? This is my wife, by the way, in case you guys don't know her. But most of those guys are false alternatives, though. You're absolutely right. You know, it's interesting. I've told some of you before that when I go around the country, particularly on the east, and we lived back east for a while as a family, I like to visit the sites that kind of where it began, if you will. Of course, it all began in the premortal existence, but you know, these great locations where, you know, like the Boston Massacre. Right now it's in the middle of a five-way intersection. And of course I have to stand right where it is. And so I'm watching the cars go by and I'm trying to, And when the timing's right, I ran out in the middle, and there's all these cars, you know, around me like this, and I'm saying, I'm standing where the Boston Massacre happened. You know, I have to do stuff like that. So maybe when I get older and I'm not as quick, I won't do it as much. But I try and find the graves of those that that signed the Declaration, for example. And I told you before how what they did for their posterity. I mean, so often they knew they weren't going to last. They weren't going to live long enough to have it happen. And so they did it for their posterity. And they said this countless times almost. And we got to do it for our posterity. You know, I think of my little ones. Yes, go ahead there and then we'll go in. That's our hope. You know, and I agree with you. And it's funny, some of you know what's going on in my life lately a little bit. And I have had emails, I've had phone calls from the weirdest sources. People that have said, I want to help. I want to be a part of this. I want to be a part of restoring the cause of liberty to this nation. And they're people that I never, honestly, would have perceived, would have cared. And it's funny that Cleon Skousen felt the same way. You know, you talk about how you met with him so regularly. We had him up to speak at our pageant, our Prelude to Freedom, which is we usually have a speech to. We're going to do a reduced version this year because of the challenges we face. But we had him up to speak, and then the next day we had him come over. We had a little homeschool group that we had converted our basement into a classroom, and we taught a classroom of. It was a kind of a co-op of homeschoolers, and I taught history and proper government, and Tammy taught a lot of things like art and literature, and she's the talented one. What? Yeah, we did the words of the prophets pretty heavily too. But at any rate, it was a basement we just converted into a classroom, and it had all the chairs and the blackboard, and it looked kind of like a classroom, but. I'd usually take long lunches and come home and teach at lunch, and Tammy and the other mothers and stuff did too. We had doctors and dentists and stuff that were there that taught biology and chemistry and things too. But anyway, after his speech, we had Cleon Skousen come over. We said, let's get the kids together and have them come address us. And Tammy had painted the stairs into our basement, red, white, and blue with stars and stripes and everything like that. And Cleon Skousen was coming downstairs, and he was kind of aged even then. This was probably 10 years ago, wasn't it, Tammy, or more? Yeah, it was more than that. Anyway, he's coming down the stairs, and he's looking at the stairs, and you know, he's kind of wondering. He's going in this basement. He says, I never knew there was people like you that lived. You know? I mean, he says, you take this serious, don't you? You bet we do. So we got in there, and we went into the room, and there was the parents were there. We had everybody sitting on the floor and everything. It was packed. And he was just delightful, and he was delighted too. But anyway, there are people out there, and I think that you're right. It'll hit the cause. Let's go here, and then we'll go here. You know, when it gets bad, it's going to get really bad. Really bad. And I don't know that, you know, I've got four little grandkids right now. And, you know, I had a picture taken the other day to put on the web because of this Senate thing that's going on. And we were trying to get a picture taken, and Tammy kept saying, you're not smiling good enough. What's wrong with you? And I'd say, I don't want a cheesy smile, you know. It's kind of, you know, you kind of think, well, you know, you don't want to look like a dorky, you know, candidate, you know. And she said, well, just think of Lily. That's my youngest granddaughter. She's only two. And I said, Lily, and a smile. And they took the picture. She says, that's the smile I want, you know. I think of those little people, You know, I just don't want them to have to do that. If we can avoid it by some diligent performance, I think it'll be worth the sacrifices. Now, it may come and it may get bad, but maybe the Lord will have mercy on us because we that cared so much can gather our loved ones. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work. I honestly don't, but I just know I've got to do everything I can right now. That's all. Let's go here and then we'll go over here. Well, you know, we really do have, as just this little review, which I'm not going to really finish. I'll do the firearms in a minute and then we'll be done maybe, but we can talk. But the evidence is overwhelming of what the truth is. If we can just get people to listen, and then remember always, they that be with us are more than they that be with them. We got to always remember that. You had a comment back here? You know, I did a, we'll go to you, Emily, in just a second, then we'll go to you. I did a radio show, what was it, Wednesday? I think it was Wednesday, up in Cache Valley, our area. And the principles that we were talking about were the foundation principles of the nation. And why was I doing this? Because I want to restore those principles. And the phone lines just, they lit up. I mean, it was like, whoa. And the talk show host that I was sitting there with, it was like, she was just taken aback. It was like, where are all these calls coming from? And they were just marvelous calls. They were principles-based. They were really searching. They wanted to know the answers. And they were incisive questions, and I was able to give them answers right out of the book, if you will, you know, what the Founding Fathers said. And she said, when we got done, she says, you know, yesterday we had a politician on that was, we didn't even get one call. That was one of the deadest things I've ever done. She says, where did these people come from? And I says, you know what, they really want to know. I said, the cause of liberty resonates in the hearts of the people, and when you give them a chance to hear it, they want to know more. She said, well, can you come back? Well, okay, I guess. But, you know, I mean, kind of thing. I've got this motto, never pass up an open microphone when you can speak in the cause of liberty. Emily, you had a comment? We really do have to. I mean, it's our duty. And I used the statement that was from the 1847 Liberty Party. They were a single-issue party. They were against slavery. They wanted to clear that abomination from the nation. And it was an overwhelming task. By then, the battle lines had almost been drawn. Of course, they did ultimately become drawn, and 600,000 Americans died in needless bloodshed. But it wasn't just over slavery, and I understand that. We could talk at length about that sometime. But the point of the matter was, they knew they had an overwhelming task. And they said, there is their motto, the duty is ours, the results are God's. And that's all we can do. As Patrick Henry said in his Give Me Liberty speech, he said, there's a just God in the heavens that will raise up friends to fight our battles for us. And I really believe that. I believe that that will happen over here. Well, I share your frustration, but quite frankly, I think the time will come, and I think there will be a time when people will be awakened, and it may be just before midnight, I don't know. But somehow, some way, there's got to be a vanguard. There just has to be. I mean, the people that came out here, I mean, think of Lewis and Clark. I mean, they kind of marked a path. They blazed the trail, if you will. They saw what was out here, and golly, it was kind of intriguing. A big land that people could be free in, you know. And these other guys, the mountain men came, and then came some pioneers, and they blazed the trail. And, you know, the pioneers thought they were doing God's work when they put a fence post in the ground. I mean, nowadays, you know, what are we doing? Oh, that's one. I'm glad I just thought of that. I was telling you how I used to go stand by the graves of some of these men. Button Gwinnett signed the Declaration of Independence. Died just a few months later. He's in a duel, but he died. These guys were passionate about the things they did. But I stood by graves of some I don't even know who they were. And they were unknown graves, in fact. They were common graves. There wasn't even a marking for each of the men's burial spot. But they were men that died in some of the battles and the wounds that they had received and so on. And they were buried in a common grave. And there's a monument now there that says, you know, here lies unknown soldiers, basically. And nobody knows their names. I'm sure God does, but we don't today. They're not on the marker anywhere, and they're not in any records or anything like that that I've been able to find. We're not all George Washingtons. We're not all Thomas Jeffersons, we're not all Benjamin Franklins or James Madison's, or, pick the ones of the great noble ones that we know. But the sacrifices that were made, that's why I brought the Braveheart thing out originally, because I wanted to tell you about the common man a little bit. You know, these royalty that are out there, you know, golly, we have so much to lose. We have lands and castles and estates. And he says, the common man that bleeds on the battlefield, does it cost him any less, you know? Not all of us will really have our names known, but they'll be known to God, I think. And that's where I think that our strength is, that we need to rally to be able to do this, regardless of where our position is in life. Frank? And you know, we've talked before, maybe a little bit, some of you, about this is not something we should be unexpected. If we go back into the 1700s, you know, the Illuminati that was established in May 1st and was discovered, and there was an official inquiry that went into it. There was court documents. There was well documented through government sources what their processes were. There were two books written that I've got. One was called Proofs of the Conspiracy, and one is called The History of Jacobism. Very dry, very dull. Well, they're not really dull, but they read kind of in a plodding way. I mean, they're not a sparkling Tom Clancy movie or book. But they talk about the oaths that these individuals took and how they infiltrated different things and so on and so forth. And one of their primary drives was to gain control of the printing presses, because they didn't have radio stations in those days and television stations and so on. And so they drove themselves to try to take control of the written material. And you say, well, okay, well, it worked then, it'll work now, maybe, whatever. Let's go here. Yeah. They've had more reporters killed per capita or whatever, however they measure it now, than they have. It could be. It's pretty easy to have a stray bullet show up in some of those situations when the fog of war is going on. You know, there are some really good... That's exactly right. And there's some really good sources out there that's well-researched, where people have gone out and done their examination of the facts and... You know, there's a lot of things that can be done, but maybe another little common sense thing like Thomas Paine did would be a good thing. George Washington felt like Thomas Paine was worth almost 100,000 men in the field, because he kind of captured the heart of the people and got them motivated. And by the way, depending on where you were in the country, everybody wasn't with this revolution that happened. I mean, there was a very small percentage that actually were on the battlefield, and not a whole bunch more oftentimes than what were the people that were behind the scenes. I mean, if you go and look at what happened in Morristown or in Valley Forge during their terrible winters there, there were people in town that had plenty and weren't sharing, you know. So there was a lot of people that didn't participate with their hearts. But let me just read you something else too. Go ahead with your comment while I'm looking this up. Well, there ought to be someone out here. Let's see. It might take me just a second. Well, any other comments while I look for this particular comment? Oh, I know. I remember where I put it. Never mind. Here's a quotation from Ezra Taft Benson. Many of us are here today because our forefathers loved truth enough that they fought at Valley Forge or crossed the plains in spite of the price it cost them or their families. We had better take our small pain now than our greater loss later. There were souls who wished afterwards that they had stood and fought with Washington and the Founding Fathers, but they waited too long. They passed up eternal glory. There has never been a greater time than now to stand up against entrenched evil. So, I mean, I think that that's a... If you want to find that, as Teachings of Ezra Taft Benson, pages 569 and 560. It was also in the conference report, April 1965, if anybody wants to look that up. But probably I'm using up my time. I'll end now very quickly, but I will talk about the right to keep and bear arms for just a second. Sometimes it comes to the point where we need the power to refuse or to counter abuse of power by some means other than words. And in his review of the Bill of Rights, Tucker touches upon this great necessity of the people to be armed to ensure that ultimately they have the ability to enforce their rights if they're ever violated. And he talked of the government that uses just the flimsiest of excuses and the most obtuse rationale to, as an excuse to disarm the citizenry of the nation. And this was happening back then, and you can read 1 Samuel chapter 13, as I recall, where the Philistines didn't want the Israelites to have smiths in their country. What was a smith? These guys could make sharp stuff, couldn't they? Swords, spears, whatever. The Philistines attempted to have Israelites disarmed. I mean, this is not a new thing. It's been going on through all history. But so Tucker touches upon this about how they'll use whatever excuse they can to disarm their citizenry. And in modern America, this has been honed to an absolute science. I mean, we have this malady of being apathetic and gullible, disinterested. I mean, you can put all of those kind of ugly terms on it, but almost any contrived method that you can think of is acceptable to our people today. I mean, it's just like, okay, you can sample my brain tissue if you want. I mean, what are we thinking? But anyway, he calls the right to keep and bear arms the true palladium of liberty. And here's what he said. This is not much longer than some of the quotes I've given you, but let me read you what he said here in this little book. This may be considered as the true palladium of liberty. The right of self-defense is the first law of nature. In most governments, it has been the study of rulers to confine this right within the narrowest limits possible. Wherever standing armies are kept up, the right of the people to keep and bear arms is, under any color or pretext whatever, prohibited. Now think about this for a second. What is one of the major arguments they use? Oh, we have the police to take care of us now. Don't. What do you fools think you ever need a firearm for? Okay, but he talks about this here. He says, wherever standing armies, or other unarmed government people, I guess we could say in this day, and the right of the people to keep and bear arms is, under any color or pretext whatever, prohibited, liberty, if not already annihilated, is on the brink of destruction. In England, the people have been disarmed, generally, under the specious pretext of preserving the game. See, they're saying there in England in his day, oh, you know, if you guys all had guns, we wouldn't have as many pheasants in our backyard. Golly, we can't have that. Or the rabbits might not be as safe or whatever, I don't know. Anyway, let me read on. I got to stop these commentaries. Okay, in England, the people have been disarmed generally under the specious pretext of preserving the game. A never-failing lure to bring over the landed aristocracy to support any measure under the mask, though calculated for very different purposes. True it is, their Bill of Rights seems at first view, to counteract this policy, but the right of bearing arms is confined to Protestants, and the words suitable to their condition and degree have been interpreted to authorize the prohibition of keeping a gun or other engine for the destruction of game to any farmer or inferior tradesman or other person not qualified to kill game. Okay? So that is, not one man in 500 can keep a gun in his house without being subject to a penalty. See, even in his day, they had largely disarmed the citizenry of England with these specious arguments that, by golly, oh, if you guys just knew how important it was to keep these game, you know, these endangered species or whatever, I don't know what they were calling them in those days. Well, anyway, again, he wanted to limit the power of government. Not he, but the people that created the Bill of Rights. And it was to limit the power of government to disarm the people. It just wasn't supposed to happen. It was the true palladium of liberty. Clark? It's absolutely true. And in fact, in the early days of the nation, it was the law. And I kind of like this law. You had to bring a gun to church, and you had to go target practicing on Sunday. Now that's... Anyway, but... I've got, and sometimes when I speak to women's groups, particularly on the Second Amendment, I bring a recording of a 911 call by a young woman who was home alone with her baby. And it is absolutely chilling. I don't know how many times I've heard that 911 call. And she's on the phone with the police, and the guy gets in her home, and you know, they're saying, well, tell him you've got the police on the phone. And she's, you know, you just hear the terror in her voice. I've got the police on the phone. This guy doesn't give a hang. Police aren't there, and there's nothing to stop him. And like I say, it's just absolutely chilling to hear this. And like I say, in the many, many times I've heard of him, he really needed 6 warning rounds in his chest when he walked in the door. And it really it really is a brutal end, is what it comes to. And you hear her screams as the 911 people can just listen, and they can't do anything about it. And it is a women's issue. It's a great equalizer. It's a way. And when I was asked the question on the talk radio show this week, a guy calls in and says, you know, a lot of politicians talk about the Second Amendment. What do you believe about the Second Amendment? And we were running out of time, and I says, well, in the interest of time, I'll tell you that it has absolutely nothing to do with hunting, plinking, target practice, or collecting. There are other lifestyle things that many people would have you believe it has to do with. It has solely to do with the protection of life, liberty, and property, and that's why the Founding Fathers made certain that the citizenry may always be armed. And the talk radio host says, whoa, you answered that one pretty succinctly. But we were almost out of time. You know, I says, well, I could give you volumes on it because the message is unequivocal. But here, Tucker talks about it a little bit. He goes on to talk again on the limits of government. I can quote Madison and stuff that happened in the convention, talk about the presidential power. We could go further in the treaty-making power. That these things were well understood in the day that the founders still lived on the earth and could amend what was ever said. But I guess we've probably made enough hay out of this right now, and I'll forego that now. It's nearly 9:30. But I thank you for being here, and I, yes, sir, again. You know, I've got lots of pages, and I'm not going to go into them, but just let me talk very briefly, a little statement by Tucker, and I want to give you another little statement by Jefferson on treaties, just so that we don't leave that one completely. Again, pages on each of these things, but here's what Tucker said. He tried to attempt to compress the matter of limited government into maybe a sentence. He says, the Congress of the United States possesses no power to regulate or interfere with the domestic concerns or police of any state. It belongs not to them to establish any rules respecting the rights of property, nor will the Constitution permit any prohibition of arms to the people or of peaceable assemblies by them for any purpose whatever, in any number, whatever they may occasion. I mean, just stuff like that, point after point after point, is given throughout this book. And then let me just touch briefly on this statement about treaties by Jefferson, even though there's several pages preceding this that would be germane too. But in the interest of time, I'll just give you this one thing I think that captures it. Again, this is Thomas Jefferson. By the general power to make treaties, the Constitution must have intended to comprehend only those objects which are usually regulated by treaty and cannot be otherwise regulated. It must have meant to accept out of these the rights reserved to the states, for surely the President and Senate cannot do by treaty what the whole government is interdicted from doing in any way. So, I mean, these men were thinkers. They understood the limits and scope of this thing. So I'll just close and thank you for being here and hope that the cause of liberty can be preserved, and God bless America.
Thank you very much, Scott. I really appreciate your being here, and I'm not meaning just I, all of us do. Just a quick sequel to what Scott was telling us about the Second Amendment issue, I hope you'll take an opportunity to find out a little more about this. If you check the NRA website, they can tell you, but the UN is planning an assault on our Second Amendment for this summer, and they've got a program planning to start on they're going to have some type of a conference or something starting on all of the insulting dates of the 4th of July. And it's going to be how, the basis of it is basically how to take our firearms away. That's in my words. But there's an excellent article in the current issue of the American Rifleman. I'm sure if you visit the NRA website, there'll probably be some information on that. But there's a lot of money behind this program, and there are apparently forces that would like to make sure that we don't have our firearms and our Second Amendment is destroyed. I just have a couple announcements. There's a sign-up sheet near the door here for those who want to sign up for the our weekly Scousen group that meets here on Thursdays when Scott isn't here. We meet every week. And the DVD of the Constitution Party 2006 candidates, including Scott Bradley, is available for a $5 donation to the Constitution Party. And also, I think most of us here probably realize that Scott is running for U.S. Senate and has registered and paid the $1,300 fee for that. I truthfully say I can't remember the last time that I have met a person that I could truly believe in for public office more than I can believe in Scott. So this time we truly have a real choice. So I hope we do the very best we can to see that a good man gets into office. I've asked Richard Bentley if he'd please give us our closing prayer.
Our dear Father in heaven, we're so grateful for the great blessings that Thou has given unto us through the Constitution of the United States and through the great contribution of the Founding Fathers, and also our blessings we have in these days. We ask Thee to help us to be diligent and stand for the truth and stand for our liberties in the way that is pleasing unto Thee. And this we say in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.